Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, you and I are going to unpack a really interesting Louisiana Supreme Court case from 1986, Robichaux v. Boot. If you're wrestling with property law or contracts, especially anything to do with buying or selling land, this case is pure gold in understanding what a right of first refusal really means in practice.
That's exactly right. For any aspiring lawyer or even someone just, you know, trying to navigate the complexities of real estate, grasping the subtleties of a right of first refusal is crucial. This case isn't just dusty legal history. It's a vivid illustration of how these clauses work and sometimes don't work in the real world.
So our mission on this deep dive is simple but vital: to cut through the legal jargon and clarify exactly what a right of first refusal is. We'll see how it stacks up against a seemingly similar concept, an option to buy. And most importantly, we'll extract the core legal principles that Robichaux v. Boot so clearly illuminates. We're essentially giving you the cheat sheet to understanding this area of law.
And to do that effectively, we'll be dissecting the case itself. We'll look at the sequence of events, the arguments presented by both sides, and the step-by-step reasoning that led the court to its ultimate decision. Think of it as a legal whodunit, but instead of a crime, we're solving a contract dispute.
Okay, let's set the scene then, laying out the crucial facts. Picture this. Back in 1966, Verla Boot sold a 50-acre tract of land to the Robichaux family. Now, here's the twist: embedded in the deed for that sale was a right of first refusal. This wasn't for the 50 acres they just bought, though. It applied to a separate piece of property nearby, Mrs. Boot's own residential home.
Exactly. This right of first refusal essentially said, if Mrs. Boot ever decided to sell her house, she had to first offer it to the Robichaux, the catch. The price had to be the same as a legitimate, bona fide offer she received from any other potential buyer, a third party, as the court would call them. This wasn't like a standing offer to the Robichaux at any time. It only kicked in if and when Mrs. Boot had a real offer in hand and decided to proceed with the sale.
Right, a critical condition. Now, fast forward about 13 years to 1979. Mrs. Boot received an offer from someone interested in buying her residential property. So she did inform the Robichaux about this, but the way she communicated this is a key point of contention in the case.
Absolutely. The notification came in the form of a letter, and what's really important to note is that in this letter, Mrs. Boot stated that she might sell the property. It wasn't a definitive, I have decided to sell and here's the offer. It was more conditional, leaving some ambiguity about her actual intentions at that moment.
And the Robichaux, their response, well, actually their lack of response, is also significant. They didn't reply to Mrs. Boot's letter at all. Then, shortly after, Mrs. Boot went ahead and sold her residential property to a third party, a couple named the Gauthier. This all happened in 1979. So the Robichaux essentially missed out.
And that's where the legal drama really begins. In 1980, the Robichaux filed a lawsuit. They weren't just looking for compensation, mind you. They wanted the sale to the Gauthier completely undone. Their argument was that Mrs. Boot had fundamentally violated their right of first refusal by selling to the Gauthier without first making a clear, proper offer to them on the same terms.
So the courtroom became the battleground for a few really critical legal questions. First and foremost, was that right of first refusal tucked into the 1966 deed even a valid and legally binding agreement in the first place? Or, as the defense would later argue, was it just a non-binding expression of intent, maybe even resembling an unenforceable option to buy?
That's a million-dollar question, isn't it? The court had to really dig into the nature of that promise. Was it a firm obligation or something? Well, something less concrete. The distinction between a right of first refusal and an option is absolutely paramount here.
Secondly, the lawyers for the defense raised the issue of Louisiana's 10-year liberative prescription. Now, for those of you who haven't encountered this yet, think of it as Louisiana's version of a statute of limitations. The argument was essentially that since more than a decade had passed between the initial 1966 deed and the 1980 lawsuit, the Robichaux's right had essentially expired due to the passage of time. It was time barred, they claimed.
The defense's reasoning was pretty straightforward on the surface. The right was created in 66. The lawsuit was in 80, ergo more than 10 years. Simple math. But the court would have to consider when that prescriptive period actually began to run. That's the key.
And finally, there was a more technical procedural question. By the time a lawsuit reached the appellate level, Mrs. Boot had unfortunately passed away. So the question arose, were her heirs absolutely essential parties to the lawsuit? Could the case proceed and be properly decided without them being formally included?
Right. That delves into the concept of who has a necessary stake in the litigation and who the judgment would directly affect. It's about ensuring all relevant parties have their day in court, but also, you know, about not unnecessarily complicating legal proceedings if possible.
All right, let's trace the path this case took through the legal system. Initially, at the trial court level, the Robichaux actually won. The judge ruled in their favor and granted what's called specific performance. Now, what does that legally weighty term actually mean in this context?
Specific performance is a powerful, equitable remedy. Essentially, the court ordered the Gauthiers to undo their purchase of the property. Instead of just awarding monetary damages, the court said, no, the contract, the right of first refusal, needs to be fulfilled exactly as it was intended. So the sale to the Gauthiers had to be reversed, and Mrs. Boot's estate would then have to offer the property to the Robichaux according to the terms of the right of first refusal.
But, as is often the case, the losing parties weren't ready to just give up. The defendants, which included Mrs. Boot's estate now, and the Gauthiers, who were about to lose their newly acquired property, decided to appeal this decision to a higher court.
And after reviewing the trial court's record and the arguments from both sides, the appellate court ultimately came to the same conclusion as the trial court. They affirmed the lower court's ruling, meaning the Robichaux's initial victory stood. So at this point, two levels of the Louisiana court system had sided with the Robichaux.
Okay, this is the crucial part. Let's really dissect the why behind these rulings. What was the court's fundamental reasoning on those key legal issues? Let's tackle the big one first. The distinction between a right of first refusal and an option to buy, what did the court have to say?
This is where the legal nuances truly shine. The court stressed that the core difference boils down to the nature of the promise being made. With an option to buy, the property owner essentially gives a potential buyer the exclusive right to purchase the property within a specific time frame, often in exchange for a separate payment, what we call consideration in contract law, something of value. The owner is obligated to sell if the option holder decides to exercise it.
So it's like putting a temporary hold on the property and the potential buyer pays for that privilege, right?
Precisely. Now, a right of first refusal, or that pacte preference we mentioned, which in essence translates to a preference agreement, is different. It's a promise that if the owner decides to sell the property and receives a legitimate offer from someone else, they will first give the holder the right, the opportunity to match that offer. It's contingent on the owner actually deciding to sell. It doesn't obligate them to sell in the first place, and typically doesn't require separate consideration if it's embedded within a larger agreement, like the sale of the 50 acres here.
And that's a critical point in this case, isn't it? The fact that the right of first refusal wasn't a standalone contract, but part of the original 1966 property sale.
Exactly. Because it was included in that initial transaction where the Robichaux purchased the 50 acres, the court reasoned that the consideration exchanged for that sale, the money the Robichaux paid, also served as the consideration for Ms. Boot, granting them the right of first refusal. No additional separate payment specifically for the ROFFR was necessary to make it a binding part of the overall agreement. It was all part of one package deal.
And what about Ms. Boot's letter to the Robichaux? How did the court interpret that in terms of whether she had made a firm offer to sell, triggering their right?
The court carefully examined the wording of Mrs. Boot's letter and concluded that it did not constitute a definitive offer to sell. Saying she might sell is just not the same as saying, I have decided to sell, and here are the terms. Because there was no firm offer from Ms. Boot to the Robichaux matching the Gauthier's offer, the Robichaux couldn't have simply accepted her letter to create a binding sale. The condition that triggered their right, a firm decision to sell, and a concrete third-party offer presented properly, hadn't been fully met in a way that obligated them to act or, frankly, created an immediate breach by Boot at that point.
Okay, let's pivot to the prescription argument. The defense was saying, look, it's been over a decade since that 66 deed, so this right is expired. What was the court's rebuttal to that line of reasoning?
The court's response was quite clear. They stated that the clock for liberative prescription doesn't just start ticking the moment the agreement is made. No, instead, it begins when the right is actually violated, or when the cause of action accrues, in other words, when there is a legal basis to sue.
And in this specific situation, when did the court pinpoint that moment of violation?
The court determined that the violation occurred in 1979, specifically when Miss Boutte sold the property to the Gauthiers without first properly offering it to the Robichaux on the same terms as the Gauthier offer. Since the Robichaux filed their lawsuit in 1980, that was clearly well within the 10-year prescriptive period from the time of the alleged breach.
So the key takeaway here is that the statute of limitations doesn't just run from the date of the contract, it runs from the date the contract is broken. That's crucial.
Precisely. And on top of that, the court also pointed out a significant lack of evidence from the defense. They hadn't presented any factual basis to actually demonstrate that the prescriptive period had indeed run. It was more of an assertion, you know, just a claim, rather than a proven fact supported by evidence.
That's a really important lesson for anyone involved in litigation, isn't it? You can't just claim a legal defense like prescription. You absolutely need to have the facts to back it up.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, let's address the argument about Mrs. Boot's heirs needing to be part of a lawsuit after her death. Why did the court ultimately decide that they weren't indispensable parties?
What was their reasoning there? It seems like the heirs of the person who made the promise would be involved.
Well, the court's reasoning hinged on the nature of the right of first refusal itself. They viewed it not just as a personal obligation of Mrs. Boot, but as a right that was attached to the property. It ran with the land, as they say in property law.
Meaning the obligation to honor the right passed on with the property itself, regardless of who owns it.
Exactly. Because the right was tied to the property, Mrs. Boot's death didn't extinguish the Robichaud's ability to enforce that right against whoever subsequently owned the property, which in this case were the Gossiers, the ones who bought it in violation of the right. Therefore, the court concluded that Mrs. Boot's heirs weren't indispensable parties whose absence would prevent the court from resolving the core dispute about the property itself. The focus was on the property and the obligations tied to it, not solely on the deceased original grantor.
So, based on all of this legal wrangling and the court's ultimate decision, what are the really key takeaways that someone studying law or even just dealing with contracts should, you know, keep in mind?
Several crucial principles emerged from Robichaud v. Boot. Firstly, it firmly establishes that in Louisiana, a right of first refusal included in a property deed is generally going to be considered a valid and enforceable part of that original contract. And critically, you don't typically need separate consideration specifically for that right if it's integrated into the larger transaction for the property.
That's a really practical point to remember when you're drafting or reviewing any kind of property agreement in Louisiana. Don't necessarily need a separate line item for the ROFR consideration.
Absolutely. Secondly, if you're looking to argue that a legal right has expired under Louisiana's liberative prescription, you can't just make a blanket statement. The court will require you to present concrete factual evidence to demonstrate that the statutory period has indeed run from the moment the right was violated. Burden of proof is on the one claiming prescription.
It's not enough to just point to the initial date of the agreement. You have to show when the breach occurred and that the lawsuit was filed outside the allowed time frame.
Got it.
Precisely. Thirdly, in cases where a right is clearly tied to a specific piece of property, like this right of first refusal was, the death of the original grantor of that right doesn't automatically mean their heirs must be brought into a lawsuit seeking to enforce that right against the property or subsequent owners. The focus remains on the property and the obligations attached to it. It simplifies things sometimes.
Yeah, that clarifies some potentially tricky procedural aspects of enforcing these kinds of rights, especially when time passes and people involved pass away.
Fourthly, Robichaud v. Boot serves as a clear precedent that specific performance actually forcing the sale to the person holding the right of first refusal is a recognized appropriate remedy for a breach of a right of first refusal in Louisiana. The courts have the power to make the seller fulfill their original promise, not just pay damages. So the Robichaud didn't just get monetary compensation, which might not have been what they really wanted. They essentially got the right to buy the property as originally intended.
Exactly. And finally, maybe the most practical lesson of all, this case really underscores the paramount importance of clear and unambiguous language when drafting any kind of contractual agreement, but especially when dealing with property rights that could last for decades. Vague or poorly defined terms can easily lead to protracted and expensive legal battles down the line as parties try to decipher the original intent.
Avoiding that ambiguity from the outset is the best way to protect everyone involved, really. It saves a lot of headaches.
Precisely. Couldn't have said it better.
So to really boil it down, our deep dive into Robichaud v. Boot gives us a crystal clear picture of how Louisiana courts interpret and enforce rights of first refusal in the context of property law. It highlights that fundamental difference between a right of first refusal and an option to buy, and it stresses the crucial understanding of when those liberative prescription periods actually start counting down, not from day one, but from the breach.
And if we zoom out and consider the broader implications, especially for anyone involved in property transactions, buying, selling, developing this case, illustrates how even seemingly minor clauses in a property deed can have significant and long-lasting legal ramifications, affecting the rights and obligations of all parties involved, for years, potentially decades.
It's a powerful reminder that even a few extra lines in a property agreement, maybe added without full consideration of future possibilities, can have major legal consequences down the road. Detail matters.
This raises a really important point for you listening. How might a deeper understanding of rights of first refusal, as illustrated by this case, influence your approach to future property dealings? Whether you're buying, selling, or advising clients, this knowledge can be a valuable tool. It's worth thinking about how you draft or review such a clause now.
Absolutely. And for those of you who want to really dive into the nitty-gritty, I'd strongly encourage you to explore the relevant articles of the Louisiana Civil Code dealing with obligations, the sale of property, and prescription. Also, looking at other Louisiana cases that have cited Robichaud v. Boot can provide even greater context and a deeper appreciation for the nuances of this area of law. See how it's been applied since 86.
There's always more to learn, and engaging with those primary legal sources, the code articles, and subsequent case law will further solidify your understanding of this important aspect of Louisiana property law.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We hope it's shed some valuable light on the intricacies of rights of first refusal. Until our next exploration.